Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 276. It's Monday, September 30th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, folks, well, let's start up first with superbugs. This from Stat News. Antimicrobial resistance can be fought, says WHO Director General. At the UN General Assembly in New York last Thursday, all countries approved a major new political declaration to radically scale up efforts to combat antimicrobial resistance, a major threat to modern medicine. As Director General of the World Health Organization, I see this declaration as a strong signal from countries that they are committed to addressing this global threat. Antimicrobial resistance threatens to unwind a century of medical progress and could return us to the pre-antibiotic era, where infections that are treatable today could become much harder to treat and potentially deadly tomorrow. Antimicrobial resistance is caused largely by the misuse and overuse of antimicrobial medicines, such as antibiotics. As a result, microbes become resistant and diseases become more dangerous and deadly. It's an issue with widespread implications. Health facilities are often where the most stubbornly treatment-resistant infections emerge and spread. Antimicrobial resistance makes all manner of routine medical procedures riskier. In low and middle-income countries, approximately 11% of people who undergo surgery are infected in the process. The burden of treatment-resistance infections falls heaviest on low and middle-income countries, where antimicrobial resistance is worsened by a lack of access to clean water, stretched health systems, limited budgets, poor access to diagnosis and appropriate treatment, and a lack of enforcement of legislation. Sepsis in newborns that spreads in hospitals is a particularly dramatic illustration of how tough the situation is in low and middle-income countries. The crisis in equitable access to new and existing antimicrobial medicines is also felt most acutely in low and middle-income countries, where lack of availability is a much bigger problem than misuse and overuse. The tools aren't there in the first place. A lack of access to vaccines increases the risk of drug-resistant infections, and a lack of access to diagnostics makes it harder to detect drug-resistant infections and prescribe the right treatments. So this is a really important context, is that while the emerging and growing antimicrobial resistance, the development of these superbugs is a real problem, if you actually look in low and middle income countries, just the fact that they're not don't even have access to the basic antibiotics and such is actually a bigger problem, causes more health problems. But, of course, antimicrobial resistance is a problem for everyone. Antimicrobial resistance also compounds the challenges in some of the world's most difficult circumstances. In Gaza, Sudan, and Ukraine, antimicrobial resistance makes wartime injuries harder to treat. Even before the current conflict, antimicrobial resistance was found to be significantly increasing in Gaza, with a 300% rise in resistance to specific antibiotics in injured patients after the 2018 and 2019 demonstrations. The drug-resistant infections that start in conflict zones rarely stay within them. As people flee, medical evacuations are arranged, and soldiers are cared for alongside civilians in hospitals. This leads antimicrobial resistance to spread. It's yet another reason why the best medicine is peace. Antimicrobial resistance causes more than 1 million deaths a year, with an escalating death toll projected over the coming decades. Addressing antimicrobial resistance is not easy. What we do know is that plans that span health, environmental, animal, and agri-food systems leads to progress, but so far they have only been pursued in high-income countries. This needs to change. But while alarms on antimicrobial resistance have been blaring ever louder, solutions have not been developed fast enough, especially on the research and development of antibiotics. Since mid-2017, only 13 new antibiotics have been authorized, with just two representing a new chemical class and considered innovative. The political declaration just approved by the UN General Assembly includes commitments and targets across human health, animal health, agriculture, and the environment. Headline commitments include reducing the global deaths associated with drug-resistant bacteria by 10% by 2030, and ensuring that at least 70% of antibiotics used for human health globally should belong to the safer WHO access group, which had the lowest potential to cause antimicrobial resistance. Projections show that many of these deaths are avoidable, including by ensuring access to life-saving antimicrobial medicines in low- and middle-income countries. This meeting's biggest opportunity is for it to become a springboard to bring in more funding, to turn the targets and commitments in its declaration into reality. The investment case for antimicrobial resistance is clear, in light of the huge cost of inaction. An April study estimates that globally, antimicrobial resistance could lead to an additional healthcare expenditure reaching as high as $412 billion annually in the next decade, if a stronger antimicrobial resistance response isn't mounted. It would also impose workforce participation and productivity losses of $443 billion. But the study also shows that implementing critical antimicrobial resistance interventions is a best buy, with $7 to $13 expected in return for every $1 invested. Boy, if you want to run public health like a business, there you go. Invest a dollar and get $7 to $13 back. Woohoo! Go public health. Make it so. Okay, well, the Director General, I think, is a little optimistic here. There isn't a whole lot of measurable objectives here. That was kind of kiboshed in there. I'll give you a specific link to in one of the bonus articles later. But the fact that you need funding and measurable objectives that can be people can be held to account to, we're still a long ways from that. Next up, more on the bird flu, this from Medical Express. With bird flu now in 34 California dairy herds, health experts watch closely. Faced with a surge in the number of California cows infected with H5N1 bird flu, state officials have quarantined 34 dairies and are urging other farms to take protective biosecurity measures. But the leap in the number of infected herds, tripling from 10 to 34 in the past week at California's 1,000 dairies, is troubling to the state's vibrant dairy industry, a major part of the state's agricultural industry and the nation's top milk producer. This is a tough moment because the state has worked to stay virus-free for 9 months, said Anya Rodabaugh, executive director of the Western United Dairies. All it took was a single breach, and it's been a disaster. Climbing case counts also worry epidemiologists and health experts who are monitoring farm workers on infected farms. The genetic mutation that enables the virus to jump from birds to cows and other mammals brings it one step closer to a human outbreak, they say. The flu pandemic of 1918, which killed more than 50 million people and sickened 500 million others worldwide, was caused by a virus that began with infected birds. I'm extremely concerned, said John Corsland, a retired USDA veterinarian epidemiologist who studies livestock diseases. The virus seems highly infectious between herds in areas with dense cattle populations, such as the Central Valley of California. The virus is a great shapeshifter. How it behaves today will likely change in the future, he said. We are at great risk of multiple poultry outbreaks and introductions into workers, wildlife, and domestic species like feral cats, rats, and mice. An investigation is still ongoing on how the virus slipped in from the outside the state, where 237 herds in 14 states are affected, said state veterinarian Dr. Annette Jones. Genetic tests show it wasn't introduced by a wild bird, but was carried in on equipment or out-of-state cattle, she said. According to one rumor, California cattle were exposed when they were shipped to Idaho, but then returned with falsified travel documents. Under state law, cows entering from infected states like Idaho must be inspected and test negative. Every producer in California should assume that neighboring producers are infected or at high risk of being infected. So this is similar to like in healthcare settings where you practice universal precautions. In the southern San Joaquin Valley, dairies are taking aggressive biosecurity steps. They are preventing all non-essential visitors, such as salesmen. Roadblocks like hay bales stop traffic. Deliveries of medicines and other important items are deposited into a secure location on the road outside the dairy. livestock trailers are being power washed with bleach solution before and after moving cattle. But in the northern stretches of the valley, compliance is more casual. Over the past 4 years, the deadly and highly contagious virus has circled the globe, taking a staggering toll on birds in more than 80 nations. A genetic analysis by University of Arizona evolutionary biologist Michael Warraby revealed that there is likely a single transmission from bird to cows, probably in Texas in late 2023. As it spreads in cattle, there are more opportunities for it to develop a new mutation that creates more severe illness in cattle or introduces it to people. The more H5N1 is spread unchecked, the bigger the reservoir and chances of further mutations to take hold, according to Scripps Research Translation Institute Eric Topol, professor of molecular medicine. It may already be too late to rid California's cattle herds of the flu virus. Okay, while one potential pandemic is brewing, we're still trying to unpack the COVID pandemic, so here's a story from MedPage Today. Sudden unexpected infant deaths rose during the pandemic. The rate of sudden unexpected infant deaths increased during the COVID-19 pandemic, with a potential link to respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, hospitalizations, according to a national study. Compared to the pre-pandemic period of March 2018 to December 2019, the risk of sudden unexpected infant death increased by a relative 6% during the pandemic, reported Catherine Pauls of Penn State Health Medical Center. Sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, cases also increased by 10% in 2021 over the pre-pandemic level period. Sudden unexpected infant death is defined as a sudden death of a child younger than 1 year of age where the cause of death is not clear prior to investigation. SIDS is an infant death that occurs during sleep and remains unexplained even after postmortem investigation. SIDS comprises more than one-third of sudden unexpected infant death cases. While sudden unexpected infant death also includes accidental suffocation in a sleeping environment and other deaths from unknown causes. Notably, seasonal shifts in RSV hospitalizations during 2021 correlated with monthly changes in sudden unexpected infant death in that same year. The most recent CDC data reveals that rates of sudden unexpected infant death remain elevated in 2022 as well. So, apparently, yet one more effect of the COVID-19 pandemic. And in other news for kids born during that period of the pandemic, this from MedPage Today, kids born during the pandemic got fewer routine vaccinations. Fewer children born during the first 2 years of the COVID-19 pandemic received recommended vaccines compared to those born in the 2 years before the pandemic, according to CDC data. Compared with vaccine coverage during 2018 and 2019, estimated coverage for children born in 2020 and 2021 declined by 1.3 to 7.8 percentage points, depending on the vaccine, as reported by the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. For example, the biggest change was influenza vaccine of two or more doses, where it dropped 7.8 percentage points. Analysis of data for earlier birth cohorts have not revealed such widespread declines in routine childhood vaccination coverage. Only 56% of children nationwide received two or more doses of influenza vaccine in 2020 to 2021, down from 63% in 2018 to 2019. Recent decreases in coverage and most of the recommended childhood vaccines could lead to a resurgence of vaccine-preventable diseases such as measles, chickenpox, and rotavirus and their associated morbidity and mortality, citing the recent surge in measles in the U.S. As of September 26, there have been 264 measles cases reported in the U.S. in 2024, and 88% of those were in people who were unvaccinated or with unknown vaccination status. Separately, the CDC recently announced that cases of whooping cough or pertussis this year exceeded levels seen before the pandemic. Because children born during or after the period of major disruption of primary care from the COVID-19 pandemic might have missed some vaccinations, providers should review children's histories and recommend needed vaccinations during every clinical encounter. Addressing financial barriers and other access issues along with vaccine hesitancy and misinformation concerns is important to increasing vaccination coverage and reducing disparities, they added. Higher provider participation in the Vaccines for Children program could help mitigate financial barriers by increasing access to no-cost vaccines. Several other recommended strategies to improve vaccine uptake include use of standing orders and other prompts, reminder and recall systems, strong physician recommendations to vaccinate, and giving vaccines in alternate settings. Okay, well, let's turn to adults as far as getting flu and COVID-19 vaccines currently. This from UPI. Survey, most Americans won't get new flu or COVID-19 vaccines. Most Americans don't plan to get vaccinated against the flu or COVID-19 this season, a new survey has found. Fewer than 2 in 5 U.S. adults, 38%, say they will definitely get a flu jab, and only 1 in 4, 26%, say they'll get the updated COVID vaccine, according to a survey by the National Foundation for Infectious Disease. This lack of interest extends to those eligible for an RSV vaccine, 21%, and pneumococcal vaccine, 24%. Last flu season, an estimated 25,000 people in the U.S. died from flu or related complications, and 75,000 from COVID-19 in 2023, demonstrating how dangerous these diseases can be, said CDC Director Dr. Mandy Cohen. Interest in vaccination is even lower this season than last, in which less than half, or 45% of adults, got a flu vaccine. Worse, only 46% of adults with chronic health conditions got the flu vaccine last season, the CDC said. The low vaccination rates among those with chronic health conditions are a particular concern because they are more likely to develop serious and even life-threatening complications from respiratory infections. Unfortunately, it appears to take catching the flu to make one want the flu vaccine. Among U.S. adults who were diagnosed with flu in the last 2 years, nearly 72% they would say they would likely get the flu jab, survey results show. The 2023 and 2024 flu season in the United States was moderately severe, with an estimated 41 million illnesses, 490,000 hospitalizations, and 25,000 deaths, according to new CDC data. Many people who don't plan to get vaccinated say they're worried about potential side effects or have general distrust of vaccines, the survey found. We must build trust by enhancing our support for people in using science and evidence to make personally appropriate decisions regarding vaccines and other health choices, said Dr. Reed Tuckson, co-founder of the Black Coalition Against COVID. Well, that's what we do here at Just for the Health of It, try to give you science and evidence to make personally appropriate decisions for yourself and your broader community. Okay, well, next up, free COVID tests are back. This from CNN. Free COVID-19 tests are available again. Here's how to get them. People in the United States can now order more free COVID-19 tests with the federal government as the country heads into respiratory virus season, with high levels of coronavirus already circulating. Each household is eligible to receive 4 at-home test kits, which can be requested from covidtests.gov starting today. They'll be shipped for free through the U.S. Postal Service. This is the program's 7th round of distribution, which has delivered more than 900 million free tests directly to U.S. residents since it started in the winter of 2021. The rapid antigen tests take about 30 minutes to give results. This next set of tests will be able to detect currently circulating variants and can be used for testing in people who have COVID-19 symptoms and those who don't, as well as in those who are up to date on their COVID-19 vaccination, as well as those who aren't. COVID-19 testing can help you know if you have COVID-19 so you can decide what to do next, like getting treatment to reduce your risk of severe illness and taking steps to lower your chances of spreading the virus to others. The U.S. FDA recommends that people take multiple rapid tests to ensure that they do not have COVID-19. 2 negative tests for those with symptoms and 3 for those without symptoms performed 48 hours apart. The CDC also recommends that everyone aged 6 months or older receive an updated COVID-19 vaccine this season to stay up to date. Okay, well, next up, update on a newer treatment that's for RSV. Infant RSV protection in the U.S. This is from the CDC. Respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, is the most common cause of hospitalization among U.S. infants. Receipt of either a maternal RSV vaccine or administration of RSV antibody to infants was first recommended during the 2023-2024 RSV season. In a CDC survey, 33% of eligible pregnant women reported receiving an RSV vaccination. Among women with live births, 45 reported that their infant received an RSV antibodies. Overall, 56% of infants were protected against severe RSV disease by either product or both. Provider recommendation for immunization was associated with higher coverage. What are the implications for public health practice? Enhanced measures to implement provider RSV immunization recommendations are needed to protect infants from severe RSV disease. Okay, the most common cause of hospitalization among U.S. infants. We have something to deal with it now. And over half of infants were protected through either maternal RSV vaccination or given RSV antibodies when they were born. So some progress there. Okay, well, let's switch gears and turn to a series of six environmental health stories. First up, from the Environmental Health Network, the Army National Guard's lead contamination problem puts civilians and soldiers at risk. The Army National Guard has failed to address widespread lead contamination in its armories, posing a health risk to soldiers and the public, especially facilities used for community activities like youth soccer. National Guard armories, many with indoor firing ranges, contain dangerous levels of lead dust, affecting both soldiers and civilians. A 2020 Army audit revealed that 600 to 1,300 armories nationwide still have lead contamination, despite decades of warnings and partial cleanups. Public spaces like New Jersey's Teaneck Armory, which hosts youth soccer events, may expose children and family to toxic lead. Key quote in this article, "You can't take a power washer and use it to clean a facility. That's prohibited. It's just going to spew lead everywhere, and it embeds it in all kinds of places, and then it comes back out." Why this matters? Lead exposure is linked to serious health issues, including kidney damage, hypertension, and irreversible neurological harm, especially in children. Failing to fully remediate armories puts both soldiers and local communities in danger. As I've reported before, if you go to a shooting range, you can have lead dust that you bring back into the home to your children, even though they never get close to the shooting range. Next up, also from the Environmental Health Network, the U.S. government funded a pesticide PR campaign that targeted critics. A government-backed private network linked to pesticide companies discredited critics, including food writers and UN experts, while downplaying the health risks of pesticides. A U.S. taxpayer-funded private network run by a PR firm has attacked critics of pesticides, including environmentalists and scientists. The network profiles critics, shares personal details, and attempts to undermine research that shows pesticides cause serious health problems. PR campaigns backed by the U.S. government aim to boost support for pesticides and GMO use globally, especially in developing countries. The key quote here from a UN food security expert, "They try and shoot the messenger. It's really hard to believe." Why this matters? This investigation reveals a growing distrust in how industry and governments handle pesticide safety and raise questions about the role taxpayer dollars play in silencing dissent. As these industries push to maintain influence in Africa, Europe, and beyond, critics continue to highlight the health and environmental risks tied to chemical-dependent farming. Next up, a story on enforcement of regulations. This is from the Environmental Health Network. Niagara Falls chemical plant emits carcinogens for years without state action. The Goodyear chemical plant in Niagara Falls has been releasing dangerous amounts of bladder-causing chemicals into the air for over a decade. And despite a violation notice, New York regulators have not required the company to fix the problem. Goodyear Niagara Falls plant emits ortho-toluidine, a carcinogen, at levels 1,000% above safe limits. That's 10 times the safe limit. New York's Department of Environmental Conservation cited the plant in 2023, but no corrective actions have been enforced. Bladder cancer rates in the Niagara County are among the highest in the nation, with residents near the plant likely exposed to dangerous emissions. Key quote is from Lois Gibbs, a former Love Canal resident. "People of low wealth are dispensable. It's just not right." Why this matters? Continued exposure to cancer-causing chemicals raises significant public health concerns, particularly for vulnerable populations. The failure to take prompt action could lead to preventable illness and community costs. And of course, even knowing whether there's a problem or not is a significant issue, and this next story from Environmental Health Network gets at that. Lakes in minority communities go largely unmonitored. A new study reveals that lakes in minority communities are far less likely to be monitored for water quality, making it harder to assess environmental risks like algae blooms. In short, research shows that lakes in predominantly minority communities are three times less likely to be monitored than those in white communities. Long-term water quality data is even scarcer in these areas, with only six lakes in Hispanic communities having long-term monitoring. Lack of data makes it hard to track water quality issues such as dangerous algae blooms, which can worsen without warning. The key quote from the study author is, Does the water quality of lakes change depending on the race and ethnicity of the people living around them? We really couldn't get to that because first we needed to know, is there even data to confidently answer that question? And we found that the answer is no. Why this matters? Without proper water quality data, minority communities could face unseen health risks from toxic lakes, mirroring a broader pattern of environmental neglect. This issue represents another layer of environmental injustice playing out across the U.S. And of course, in public health, assessment and surveillance is one of the fundamental task that needs to be done. You need to know that you have a problem before you can deal with it. Next up, we have a story that shows that, private profit can often be run counter to public health. This is from the Environmental Health Network. Private equity funds toxic lead chromate industry, sparking concerns from health experts. U.S. private equity firms have expanded into the global market for lead chromate, a chemical tied to lead poisoning and cancer, raising alarms among health experts over its continued use in poorer nations. Blackstone and American Securities LLC acquired firms that distribute lead chromate, despite its known health risks and restrictions in wealthier countries. Lead chromate is used in paints and industrial applications in many developing nations, where regulations are less stringent or non-existent. Health experts are concerned about the long-term effects of lead exposure from these products, particularly on children. There is definitely an opportunity to sell more lead chromate pigments in developing countries where they would be needed. There generally are fewer regulations in these regions regarding what types of pigments can be used. This is from the executive director of the U.S. Pigment Lobby Group. Why this matters? Lead exposure is a serious public health issue, especially in developing nations. With private equity firms fueling its production, global health risks could rise, especially in vulnerable communities where regulations lag behind. Yes, if you can make a buck on the back of a health problem for somebody else, I guess that's capitalism's answer. Okay, well, all of that leads us to a more sweeping story on the toxicity of soil and water. This from Science Daily. Soil and water pollution, an invisible threat to cardiovascular health. Pesticides, heavy metals, micro and nanoplastics in the soil, and environmentally harmful chemicals can have a detrimental effect on the cardiovascular system, according to a review paper published in Nature Reviews Cardiology. The article provides an overview of the effects of soil and water pollution on human health and pathology, and discusses the prevalence of soil and water pollutants and how they negatively affect health, particularly the risk of heart health. Illnesses related to chemical pollution of the soil, water, and air are responsible for an estimated 9 million premature deaths annually, which equates to 16% of all global deaths. Half of these deaths are of cardiovascular origin. Degradation of the soil threatens the health of at least 3.2 billion people. That's 40% of the global population. In contrast, more than 2 billion people, that's 25% of the global population, live in countries that are particularly affected by water pollution. Eco-disruptive causes of soil and water pollution include deforestation, climate change, airborne dust, over-fertilization, and unhealthy city designs. Pollution by heavy metals, pesticides, and micro or nanoplastics cause cardiovascular damage by inducing oxidative stress, inflammation, and impairing circadian rhythms. Exposure to chemicals such as heavy metals, solvents, dioxins, and pesticides at workplaces through consumer products or indirectly via environmental contamination contributes to endothelial dysfunction and cardiovascular disease. The potential hazards of contaminated air dust are also becoming increasingly important, commonly known as Sahara or desert dust, for example. Around 770,000 cardiovascular deaths per year can be attributed to dust pollution. Unfortunately, climate models predict that the airborne dust will increase significantly and that air quality will deteriorate as the planet warms, comments Professor Dr. Leila Veld from the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry. Controlling soil and water pollution is crucial to reducing cardiovascular risk. Key strategies include reducing exposure to harmful chemicals through improved water filtration, air quality management, and adherence to good agricultural practices. Promoting sustainable urban design, reducing the use of harmful pesticides, and improving environmental regulations worldwide are also essential to tackle the causes of soil and water pollution. These measures protect ecosystems and public health, particularly by reducing the incidence of cardiovascular disease caused by pollution. So there you go. Worldwide, heart disease is a leading cause of death, and half of those are related to environmental pollution. Yikes. Just another one of the social determinants that's very hard to control as an individual, something we should all be concerned about. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, next up, a story on the rural-urban divide. This from Science Daily. Growing divide. Rural men are living shorter, less healthy lives than their urban counterparts. Higher rates of smoking, obesity, and cardiovascular conditions among rural men are helping fuel an urban-rural divide in illness, and this gap has grown over time, according to a study published in the Journal of Rural Health. The findings suggest that by the time rural men reach age 60, there are limited opportunities to fully address this disparity, and earlier interventions may be needed to prevent it from widening further. They found 60-year-old rural men can now expect to live 2 years less than their urban counterparts, a gap that's nearly tripled from two decades ago. Rural men can also expect to live 1.8 fewer years in quality health than urban men, with this disparity more than doubling over the same period. For women, the urban-rural gap in life expectancy and health quality is much smaller and grew more slowly over time. Nearly a decade after a landmark study found that people with lower levels of education are more likely to die from so-called deaths of despair, such as drug overdose or suicide, this new study finds that while education was an important factor in determining health quality, it cannot fully explain the gap between urban and rural populations. After adjusting rural education levels to match those of urban areas, the gap in healthy life expectancy was cut nearly in half. However, disparities exist within each educational group, suggesting important geographic factors beyond education contribute to differences in healthy life expectancy. Yep, the health of men in red America is not doing well. Okay, well, next up we have a story that proves the rule that sometimes the best you can do is not get any worse. This is from the Associated Press. U.S. suicides held steady in 2023 at a very high level. The U.S. suicides last year remained at about the highest level in the nation's history, preliminary data suggests. A little over 49,300 suicide deaths were reported in 2023, according to provisional data from the CDC. That number could grow a little as some death investigations are wrapped up and reported. Just under 49,500 suicides were reported in 2022, according to final data released just last Thursday. The numbers are close enough that the suicide rate for the 2 years is considered the same, CDC officials said. U.S. suicide rates have been rising for nearly 20 years, aside from a two-year drop around the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. So leveling off of any increase in suicide is cautiously promising news, said Catherine Keyes, a Columbia University public health professor who studies suicide. And again, just note, you know, people look at the trauma of the early pandemic, suicide rates actually went down. So perhaps not having to go to work is a positive for your health. Experts caution that suicide, the nation's 11th leading cause of death in 2022, is complicated and that attempts can be driven by a range of factors. Contributors include higher rates of depression, limited availability of mental health services, and the availability of guns. About 55% of all suicide deaths in 2022 involved firearms. The CDC report also said suicide was a leading cause of death for people ages 10 to 14 and 20 to 34, and the third leading cause for people ages 15 to 19. Deaths continue to be more common among boys and men than girls and women. The highest suicide rate for any group by far was in men ages 75 and older, at about 45 suicides each year per 100,000 men that age. Among women, the highest rate was those who were middle-aged, about 9 per 100,000. But more dramatic increases have been seen in teens and young women, with the rate of that group doubling in the last two decades. The overall suicide rate in 2022 and 2023 was 14.2 per 100,000. It also was that high in 2018. Before then, it hadn't been that high since 1941. Okay, well, next up we have a story on the continued price gouging of Medicare Advantage, which I like to call Medicare Disadvantage. This from Modern Healthcare. Medicare Advantage overpayments highlighted in Office of Inspector General reports. Three health insurance companies overcharged taxpayers by more than $140 million combined by exaggerating the severity of Medicare Advantage members' illnesses, according to reports of the Health and Human Services Department Office of Inspector General. Medicare Advantage carriers are paid more for covering enrollees who are sicker or more complex and consume more health care. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services bases these sick payments on the diagnosis codes insurers submit. In all three cases, the Office of Inspector General concludes that Humana, Emblem Health, and Health Assurance used codes that did not match patient medical records. Despite the findings, the Office of Inspector General recommends that two of the insurers repay only a fraction of the alleged overpayments it detected. The auditing agency recommends that Emblem Health give back only just over $500,000 and Humana refund $6.8 million, but the Inspector General says health insurance should return the full $4.2 million. This discrepancy stems from limitations that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services placed on itself in the Medicare Risk Adjustment Data Validation Program final rule last year. In 2018, the agency proposed giving itself the authority to claw back Medicare Advantage risk adjustment overpayments from 2011 on, which triggered intense opposition from the insurance industry. When the agency finalized the regulation in 2023, it allowed recoupments dating from 2018 or later. At that time, CMS projected it would collect $4.7 billion in overpayments from 2023 to 2032. Humana has sued to block the policy. Okay, well, let's finish the regular reporting of this episode with a story that gets at how the profit motive does not serve the best clinical care. This is from Medical Express. Clinical cancer research in the U.S. is increasingly dominated by pharmaceutical industry sponsors. Researchers identified a substantial increase over the past decade in the proportion of patients with cancer in the U.S. who participate in pharmaceutical industry-sponsored clinical trials compared to those conducted with federal government support. Published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, these findings reveal trends of underinvestment in federally funded studies, flat enrollment counts in federally funded studies over more than a decade, and a growing reliance on industry to conduct cancer research. The study showed that between 2018 and 2022, industry-sponsored trials enrolled over 8 times more patients than federally sponsored trials. For adult trials, industry enrolled nearly 10 times more patients. These ratios have also grown substantially over time. Compared to a decade early, 2008 to 2012, the proportion of enrollments attributable to industry versus federal support increased from 4.8 to 9.6, that's a ratio, and from 0.7 to 2.3. So it doubled for adults and over tripled the ratio for children. The study was conducted in more than 26,000 cancer clinical studies in adults and children using data from clinicaltrials.gov. The magnitude of difference revealed by the study, which was the first to comprehensively evaluate the comparative roles of industry and federal sponsors in supporting patient enrollments to cancer studies, took the researchers by surprise. Federally funded cancer research studies play a critical role due to their demographic diversity. For example, 3 times more Black participants were enrolled in federally supported research than in industry-funded research. In addition to investigating cancer treatments, federally funded research covers a broad set of clinical research questions, such as combining treatment modalities or examining whether approved drugs work in other cancers. Industry-funded cancer research predominantly aims to support new drug approvals. Underinvestment in federally funded cancer clinical research results in missed opportunities for scientific, clinical, and population advances. Federally funded cancer clinical trials have contributed to more than 14 million life years gained over 4 decades and have helped improve clinical care guidelines for patients. So this is another example of public health versus private wealth, that when you're geared towards just getting new drug approvals, you lose out on the broader clinical goals of providing the best care, in this case, to cancer patients. Okay, well, that brings us to our next feature of the show, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give that link again at the end of the list. Well, folks, we have a record number 48 bonus articles smashing the old record, so let's get to it. First up, let's start with one of the pillars of health, sleep. Nighttime noise linked to restless nights for airport neighbors. So, well, you might not live next to an airport, but this just makes the point that a lot of noise pollution can disrupt sleep. And sleep is a basic foundation for our health. Bonus article 2. Firearm laws restricting large capacity magazines found to be effective in reducing child deaths in mass shootings. So this is mass shootings. That's when you get 4 or more people that are shot. And obviously being able to shoot a lot at once that has a big effect on that. Bonus article 3, safe storage and minimum age gun laws would curb gun violence. And layering a variety of firearm policies would likely work best to prevent deaths. So of course, gun violence is a very complicated thing. You need more than one strategy to deal with it. But safe storage and minimum age gun laws do seem to help. Bonus article 4, parents are open to firearms counseling from doctors, but ensuring secure storage remains a challenge. So this was of parents of kids who came in like with mental health crises and that type of thing. And they were very interested in talking about firearms. But an interesting fact in this little particular study was that 19% of the healthcare providers who owned a gun did not store them safely. So maybe they're not the best people to counsel on that. Bonus article 5. Women are increasingly using firearms in suicide deaths, as women increasingly own guns. Of course, having a gun increases your chance of shooting yourself with a gun, intentionally in that case of suicide. Bonus article 6. Biden issues executive order to minimize trauma of active shooter drills and to restrict some machine gun devices. Of course, getting machine gun devices is an obvious one. The minimizing trauma of active shooter drills is basically we know very little about what benefit, and we definitely know about some harms of active shooter drills. So to better study that, only do use active shooter drills when you really need to, and make sure that they're not causing collateral damage of trauma. Bonus article 7. The odds of surviving a shooting are getting worse as guns become more lethal. So as our the population of guns in this country becomes increasingly military guns, that is, of course, military guns are intended to kill people with great efficiency. Okay, well, bonus article 8 is a little bit better news. This is racial justice activism and advocacy found to reduce depression, anxiety in some teens. Basically, just highlighting the fact that if you have depression and anxiety, that having an opportunity to actually do something about that anxiety or depression can be helpful. Bonus article 9, another form of trauma. Study of formal NFL players finds 1 in 3 believe they have CTE. That's a concussion syndrome. And anxiety over CTE may mask getting help for other cognitive issues that are actually treatable. So you may be despairing a bit, thinking that you got this untreatable concussion syndrome, when in fact, some of your cognitive issues may be things that could actually be treated. Bonus article 10. Plastic recycling claims face scrutiny as Federal Trade Commission plans tougher rules for manufacturers. Very good. Bonus article 11. California sues ExxonMobil over deceptively promoting chemical recycling as a solution to the plastics crisis. So with existing laws, that can be subject to a lawsuit. Way to go, California. Bonus article 12. EPA data make it hard to know the extent of the contamination from last year's Ohio derailment. This is the East Palestine train derailment. And the problem here is that there was data that was detected where chemicals were detected at a reliable level, but because they're below a certain level, they're not reporting it. This type of lack of transparency is not good for public confidence. It doesn't allow a public researchers to research public data. We should take full advantage to assure people and to do research to prevent future harms. Bonus article 13. Signs warning of radioactive waste to be installed along Missouri's Coldwater Creek, winding for 14 miles between homes and parks. So this has been polluted for decades and decades, but just now they're putting up signs to say, hey folks, don't play near the creek or go near it. 14 miles. Whew. Yeah, that's a disaster. So, hey, just because you don't know something there doesn't mean we know that radioactive waste is not good. And many places in the country are polluted. Bonus article 14. Michigan polluters save money with short-term fixes, leaving future generations to bear the costs. So this is just mitigating in the short term the worst effects, but not actually solving the underlying problem, which leaves the more expensive cleanup cost to later generations. Yes, America, way to go, putting it on our grandkids' credit card. Bonus article 15. Democrats prioritize economy of fossil fuels over global climate goals. So you might not have heard about climate change in the presidential election, that's for sure. But it seems that, having a lot of energy, which basically translates into fossil fuels as well, that seems to be more important than dealing with climate change. Bonus article 16, why the EPA chief backed down on environmental justice promises. So you want to drill down on why those promises get compromised. Good story there. Bonus article 17. Veterinary medicine is key to overcoming antimicrobial resistance through prudent and proper use of antibiotics in livestock. And a follow-up story, 18, the U.S. weakens global effort to fight antibiotic resistance in livestock. This is the one I referenced earlier in the show that the U.S. is trying to weaken the antimicrobial resistance agreements at the World Health Organization to not have to clamp down on antibiotic use in U.S. livestock. Bonus Article 19. U.S. farmers call for vaccine option to fight bird flu as wildfowl migration begins. So with the wildfowl migration, these wild birds are the ones that transfer bird flu to these concentrated animal feeding operations, the chickens in this case. And they're looking, it's getting bad enough that the farmers actually want to have a vaccine option to help combat the bird flu. Bonus Article 20. Review finds serious gaps in steps to control bird flu in mammals. So another growing reservoir. We call it bird flu, but it's present in over 50 mammal species. Bonus Article 21. Why are we seeing more pandemics? Our impact on the planet has a lot to do with it. So this is just another good overview of the so-called One Health approach, where we start to view human health and planetary health as actually one thing. Bonus Article 22. COVID-19 reinfection ups risk of long COVID, new data shows. And this, if you're just looking at the number of documented infections that people have, it's pretty much a direct increased risk. Every infection increases your chance proportionally in this particular study. That's a little higher than what other ones had, but definitely each new infection raises the possibility of long COVID. Bonus Article 23. Research shows methadone and other substance use disorder treatments in jail reduces recidivism. So even if you don't care about drug use treatment, it prevents recidivism since the vast majority of people that are in jails and prisons in this country have substance use and or mental health problems. And related to that, bonus Article 24, study reveals fewer than half of U.S. jails provide treatment for opioid use disorder, even though it is effective on both the law enforcement front and the health front. Bonus Article 25. Poppy cultivation in Afghanistan is at an all-time low with Taliban rule, but heroin flows unabated as stockpiles and world production far exceed demand. This is just an interesting long read, and you actually will not find this in the U.S. media. This is like a Swiss story, because we don't like saying anything positive about the Taliban. In fact, when the U.S. went into Afghanistan, one of the first things they did was jack up heroin production, poppy cultivation, because it was economically advantageous. That's the way it was seen. Interesting story. Bonus Article 26. Negative body image among teens is a global issue, and it's linked to social media use. Bonus Article 27. The World Health Organization sees a rapid rise in problematic social media use for European teens. So this is rising rapidly. Okay, let's do a couple more practical things for listeners here. Bonus Article 28. Can we safely use melamine dishes and polyamide plastic utensils? The short answer is no. If you want more details, read that story. Bonus Article 29. Is stainless steel or cast iron cookware best? I'd say probably stainless steel, but if you have iron deficiency, cast iron cookware can be good because it releases some iron into the food. Is Teflon safe? Short answer, no. Bonus Article 30. Diet-related diseases are the number one cause of death in the U.S., yet many doctors receive little or no nutrition education in medical school. Just an example that we're not prevention-oriented. Number one cause of death as far as risk factors, diet, and doctors are no more educated than the average person. Bonus Article 31. I'm an OB-GYN in the South. Abortion bans make it impossible to do no harm. So that kind of speaks for itself. Bonus Article 32. More women are charged with pregnancy-related crimes since Roe's end. So this is kind of the tip of the spear on chilling the population with anti-abortion efforts. And coming up in the future, perhaps, bonus Article 33, big tech and surveillance would be key to delivering Project 2025's anti-abortion plans. So you may not have sweeping legislation, but you can do another way to chill the population is through surveillance. Bonus Article 34. Will abortion swing the first post-Roe presidential election? This is a good overview of how abortion is playing out in the seven swing states. Bonus Article 35. How America's healthcare system fails women in pain. The experience of pain is different in women, and the healthcare system does poorly in addressing it. Bonus Article 36. Pentagon to spend $500 million on women's health research, and the NIH $200 million. Isn't that a little weird that the Pentagon is spending 2.5 times more than the NIH? This is actually some new dollars, I think, that was announced. But I would just point out that the Pentagon, being the largest sacred cow in the federal government, seems to be the tail wagging the dog. The Pentagon, which of course employs way more men than women and is very patriarchal. It's nice to see, I guess, that they're trying to look at women's health research, but a lot of it's pretty basic research. It's just a question in my mind about having civilian control rather than military control over basic health research for women. Why don't we move that to the NIH? Bonus article 37. Israel deliberately blocked humanitarian aid to Gaza, two governmental bodies concluded. Secretary of State Antony Blinken rejected them to avoid having to cut off arms aid. So this is an example where, you know, of course, humanitarian aid, when you have humanitarian catastrophes, is really important for public health. But in order to keep sending arms with no conditions, the Secretary of State had to ignore its own government bodies. Bonus article 38. NIH neuroscience leader committed research misconduct, the agency says. And a related story, 39, new Health and Human Service rules can't address the primary reason for research misconduct. Publish or perish must perish. So this is just the unending need to publish, 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 which doesn't necessarily serve the best science. Bonus article 40, severe obesity is on the rise in the U.S., so this is the severest form of obesity is what's rising the most. Crossing the threshold from normal weight to overweight or obese hasn't changed, but within those categories, we're seeing greater levels of obesity. Bonus article 41. The data are clear. Patients regain weight after stopping GLP-1 weight loss drugs. So if you continue to take those, you can keep the weight loss. But if you stop, that weight is going to come back. This is very similar to a lot of weight loss miracles that we've seen before. These drugs are very powerful, but they may have to be taken for the rest of your life. Bonus article 42. Millions of Americans want to quit smoking. Critics say drug makers and the FDA are failing them. So this is, again, having to do with the drug makers not being able to profit as much, in their view, from quit smoking methods, pharmaceutical methods. And the FDA hasn't been pushing it very well either to encourage drug makers to develop better quit smoking drugs. Bonus article 43. Is comprehensive genetic testing worth it for patients with cancer? We don't know and can't say yes, as profit motive versus best clinical care reigns in research. This is another example where we're rushing to get this testing, often very expensive, and the companies that are doing the testing make a lot of money, but we're not researching it in the way is whether that testing is effective and cost effective for patients with cancer. Bonus article 44, the Medicare Advantage influence machine. Revealed through court filings. So sometimes we learn a lot through court filings that we would not get public information otherwise. And Medicare Advantage, not surprisingly, making billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars every year, is of course going to try to influence the regulatory bodies and politicians in order to keep that money flowing. Bonus article 45. Nonprofit hospitals took in over $37 billion in tax benefits in 2021. And the good news in this article is that these researchers are offering ways that local communities can try to leverage community benefit from those nonprofit hospitals. Bonus article 46. Expiring ACA subsidies could affect 2 million chronically ill people. So, next year, these ACA subsidies for middle and higher income folks is going to drop, and they project that if without those subsidies, 2 million chronically ill people will lose their health care coverage. Yikes. Bonus article 47. 77% of IT, information technology, healthcare employees want to leave their job. So healthcare is a very difficult place to work. Healthcare is the largest concentration of cybersecurity attacks. If you've ever worked with any of the healthcare information systems, you know that those are a mess. So there's probably greener grass elsewhere. Need to do a better job to make healthcare a functional workplace. Bonus article 48, last but not least, fluoride in drinking water poses enough risk to merit new EPA action, a judge rules. Now, this I think is actually a good example of where maybe the courts are not the best to make this decision. So, this research that I reported on in earlier episodes was the first government review that said with moderate confidence that at high levels, higher than what's found normally in drinking water and higher than what's allowed when you're fluoridating water, can cause drops in IQ. So the thing is, 0.6% of the population has levels that were addressed in this scientific study of moderate confidence that would be relevant for that 0.6% of the U.S. population, almost 2 million people, who have naturally high fluoride in their drinking water. So the judge, who doesn't really know the science behind this, says, oh, the EPA should be looking at it, which isn't necessarily bad, but the science of like trying to go and take fluoride out of water is a lot different than what the anti-fluorid people are doing, are trying to stop modest fluoridation of water that helps teeth and bone strength and that type of thing. So just an interesting interface between the scientific community and judges. You can read all 48 of these stories, any one of them, or any story that I've reported on in previous episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-